Hello and welcome to Dialex. Welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM. That's 103.2 FM up there in Preston. Radio Verulam in St Albans and our listeners also in Swindon on Swindon FM. Coming up on this week's show.
A sad and lonely figure whom fate had called upon to shoulder so young, so heavy a burden.
60 years ago this month, on the 6th of February, George VI died and Queen Elizabeth II, then only 25 years old, succeeded to the throne. We look back at the event with some archive material from 1952. Also this week...
So there are big candles, and this one was only halfway down, and he nicked his thumb and forefinger and put the flame out.
Coming off the show, we've got Harold Utting, and he's going to be telling us about his father, a superintendent at Arnosvale Cemetery. And following that...
A brother-in-law, Hugh, using a sack stitching machine, which is they use for storing grain, stitched up the sheet, so he was, well and truly stitched up.
You can hear how one family did their own funeral. Also this week, I'm speaking to regular contributor Colin McNamee. We've also got Tony Gosling with another instalment of Clifton's Edwardian ghost hunter Montague Summers. Malcolm Greaves reads us another chapter of Treasure Island. We've got poetry from Rosemary Dunn and Tim Burrows, and Jeff Sparks, not in the studio this week, but he's provided us What's On Guidance Song of the Week, so I'll read it out for you. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm Michael Noyce. Before we introduce our first guest, we're going to play the Minstrel's Song from Aiella by Thomas Chatterton, read for us by Malcolm Greave.
The Minstrel's Song from Aiella by Thomas Chatterton. Oh, sing unto my roundelay. Oh, drop the briny tear with me. Dance nemo at halliday, like a raining river be. My love is dead, gone to his death bed, all under the willow tree. Black his crying as the winter night, white his road as the summer snow, rod his face as the morning light, kale he lies in the grave below. My love is dead, gone to his death bed, all under the willow tree. Swote his tongue as a throstle's note, quick and dance as thought can be, deaf to his table, cudgel stout. Oh, he lies by the willow tree. My love is dead, gone to his deathbed, all under the willow tree. Hark! The raven flappeth his wing in the briar dell below. Hark! The death owl loud doth sing to the nightmares as he go. My love is dead, gone to his deathbed, all under the willow tree. See, the white moon sheens on he. Whiter is my true love's shroud, whiter yon the morning sky, whiter yon the evening cloud. My love is dead, gone to his death bed, all under the willow tree. Here upon my true love's grave shall the barren fleurs be laid. Nee one holly sanct to save, all the kelness of a maid. My love is dead, gone to his deathbed, all under the willow tree. With my hands I'll dent the briars round his holly corse to grow. Oof and fairy, light your fires. Here, my body still shall be. My love is dead, gone to his deathbed, all under the willow tree. Come, with acorn cup and thorn, drain my heart's blood away. Life and all its good I scorn. Dance by night or feast by day. My love is dead, gone to his death bed, all under the willow tree. Water which is crowned with wraiths, bear me to your lethal tide. I die, I come, my true love waits. Thus the damsel spake and died.
That was The Minstrel Song from Ayala by Thomas Chatterton, read for us expertly by Malcolm Grieve. Thomas Chatterton was born in 1752 opposite St Mary Redcliffe Church in Bristol. He died in London, aged only 17, in 1770.
It's my great pleasure to introduce Colin McNamee. You are here in an individual capacity, but also you've spoke at Dialect recently about UKIP and your involvement with that party. You're here today to talk about housing. Now, obviously, we've got a very large lack of affordable housing at the moment, and there are several kind of government schemes and things to try and sort that out. Now, what's your take on this?
Yeah, hi, Michaela. The main thing that seems to be being driven is the need for housing. But behind that is what's causing the need. I agree there is a huge requirement for social housing. The Conservative government got it really wrong. It was a good idea to sell off council housing. That brought people into the property market. But a really bad idea not to reinvest that money into council housing or, as it has now become, social housing. In the village where I live, which is Boltonsborough in Somerset, a dire need for social housing. But there is not a dire need for a huge development of ordinary houses for sale. And I feel that that applies across the country. The demand for housing is primarily being fueled by immigration.
Okay, what do you have to kind of support that?
Well, the numbers, Immigration Watch, for example, are talking about the official figures, and there's a report by Immigration Watch, the official figures that the population of this country will be heading towards 70 million. Two-thirds of that increase will be by immigrants. There is no basis, and I should add that the indigenous population, the birth rate is 1.6. The immigrant's birth rate is between 4 and 5. So you're looking at a birth rate of times 3, the indigenous population. So 20, 30 years down the piece, there's a problem yet to come. So the government, particularly the Labour government and its open door policy on immigration, has potentially ruin this country, not only for now, but for the future. A lot of the concern is talked about NHS and the demands being placed on the NHS. Now, a lot of immigrants go back to the Jamaicans in the 50s, the Jews in the 30s, the Irish in the 50s. They've all contributed to the economy and the culture of this country. But to try to force, which is what the Labour government did, a multicultural society by opening up the floodgates, and they did have the option to restrict the numbers and chose not to do it. But it's not just Labour. Coming up to the 2010 general election, David Cameron was saying that he would, if elected, control immigration into this country. Now, that was said time and time again. However, it was then modified, as things that he says usually are. And the words from outside the EU came in.
Now, that's a legal requirement. As we are members of the European Union, then we are signed up essentially to EU free movement of people. And there's not really much you can do about that, is it?
Yes. Tony Blair, at the time of signing, and this was particularly the Lisbon Treaty, as opposed to the Maastricht Treaty in 92, the Lisbon Treaty, there were opt-outs, which France and Germany took. And that was to restrict the amount of movement of people coming into their countries from the EU. Tony Blair decided not to do that, so he opened the floodgates. So yes, you're right, it is a legal requirement now because of the Labour government, but Cameron would have known that in his general election addresses when he was saying he would control immigration. There was no qualification.
So he's misrepresented that claim.
Absolutely. Okay. But then he, as you get nearer to the general election, and certainly afterwards, the emphasis is on immigration from outside the EU. It's another way in which the effect of the EU on this country is being misrepresented.
But your particular kind of area you want to focus on is housing. Tell me more about why people aren't talking about the fact that all of the immigrant numbers and how they're increasing, what effect that's having on housing and policy at the moment in this country.
Right, the immigrants are coming in, from their point of view, quite reasonably looking for a better life. Not talking about asylum seekers, just talking about the numbers of immigrants. And they go into the cities. Now, it's initially what gets reported are the numbers of immigrants coming in. What isn't reported is the ripple effect. And the ripple effect is they move into the cities, people who are living in the cities start to look outside and they go to smaller cities, they go to towns and they go to villages. So there is a demand being created from the centres, if you like, the big population areas, because of immigration. Then the demand comes down through to the villages. Now this is replicated right across the country. The government has brought in a strategic review for housing, and landowners can register without planning permission at this stage their interest in developing fields that they own or land that they own for housing development, that strategic review. Running concurrently with this, the government is reducing the planning permissions and regulations that currently abide mainly with the district councils, not with parish councils. Parish council is an advisory only, doesn't have to be listened to. And so that is being put forward by the government as putting more power to the people at a local level. But those people don't have the same expertise. They might be local, but they don't have the same expertise as planning officers in the district councils. I believe that pushed to the extremities, more properties will be built without the safeguard of proper planning regulations, because so far, every time, and unfortunately a tendency, certainly with the Labour government and with this coalition government, is micromanagement of our lives, as opposed to macro management. If they just threw up a framework and let the rest of us get on with it, instead they want to micromanage everything. And this is what is happening now. So you get the ripple effect coming through, and then I've mentioned about the births. So the immigrant times three births, and that will be building in a problem for 20 years' time. We've got a problem now from 10 years ago, and Immigration Watch have got a petition running, which is online, and the official figures, the population of this country will reach 70 million within 20 years. Two-thirds of that increase will be immigrants. The country isn't going to cope.
Right. Well, that's pretty dramatic. In terms of the affordable housing, so people, first-time buyers, finding it very difficult. In terms of the strategic review that you've mentioned, what does the government think it's trying to achieve? Like, from purely their point of view, what do they think they're trying to get at here?
To get as many houses built as possible. Social housing may or may not be part of that mix. At the moment, if a developer wants planning permission, he has to include a number of social houses within that mix to get it through.
So it's just numbers. That's all they're trying to get.
It's numbers.
And that looks much better on them. And actually, there's also an argument, I suppose, that we need to start building houses to jumpstart the economy. Builders need to be working. We need to get more houses up purely on that regard. So what would you say about that?
Well, if the government was serious about that, instead of increasing VAT from 17.5% to 20%, they could reduce VAT on building materials for either a new build and, for that matter, for home improvement. Instead, they've lumped it all under 20% and they've not differentiated. If they were serious, they'd start thinking about the policies rather than bring in a blanket policy and then affect it afterwards. And yes, the economy does need to be built. But why are we in this state? It's not really all to do with the bankers. It really isn't. What about mismanagement under Labour?
So there are kind of two streams to your kind of criticism, I suppose. Immigration is inflating numbers, people needing houses, but also the houses that are being pushed through and we're trying to build, the government scheme, is purely numbers based, and actually the houses that are built won't have any social housing regulations attached to them. They won't actually solve this problem, in effect.
They might solve the problem and there might be regulation. But if you look at the numbers of houses going into development at the moment that mean little roads and limited parking, one car to a house? Don't think so. A three-bedroom house with one car and roads so narrow that you can't put one car on them because they block the road? It's not a genuine solution.
So that e-petition you mentioned from Migration Watch, how can people find out more?
Yeah, thanks, Michaela. I have been referring to Immigration Watch. You're quite right. It is Migration Watch. And Sir Andrew Green has a petition online to talk about keeping the numbers, getting the UK government to control the numbers. The petition is online at http://epetitions.direct.gov.uk/petitions/1965/8. For those of you that remember Dick Barton, I won't repeat it again, but it is there.
Over the last century, one of the world's leading authorities on the supernatural, as well as world expert on cannibalism and vampires, believe it or not, was the son of Clifton Banker and one-time curate in Bath and Bitton, the Reverend Montague Summers. He died just after World War II, but his writings about those who abandon God and open the forbidden doors to the other side on vampires and demonology live on. A bishop who today follows the independent Catholic tradition dedicated his best-selling book, The Highgate Vampire, to Montague Summers. Dialect's Tony Gosling has been asking the Right Reverend Bishop Sean Manchester about similarities between his own journey of faith and that of Bristol's Edwardian eccentric. This week, they discuss the Harry Potter brand of witchcraft and why this has little to do with the true diabolism.
They need to seek out and be in contact with a traditionalist priest who is au fait with the means to deal with their particular problem. So he would need to be proficient in exorcism, and he would need to be acquainted with the workings of these things. And if their own local priest is not, as most likely is the case, they need to ask him to refer them, as you might when you go to your GP and he has to refer you to a consultant because he's just not able to deal with your problem. Likewise, they need to go to their local minister or priest and ask to be referred. And it's very likely that that referral will take them to a traditionalist-minded person who would nevertheless have to have the permission of his bishop in order to actually carry out an exorcism. In all the churches, I believe it's required that a priest cannot take it upon himself to administer the rituale or Romanum, to exorcise in the traditional ancient and approved way.
With Montague Summers, which of his books would you most recommend on this subject, the spirit world or witchcraft?
You know, it's very difficult because Montague Summers, who translated the Malleus Maleficarum, was quite extreme in a way perhaps that I'm not. I mean, in his day, the Witchcraft Act still obtained. It hadn't been done away with as it was in the early 50s. But he wanted to destroy the early 18th century Witchcraft Act, which had been somewhat revised. He believed in dealing with them in the way that they are dealt with in the Hammer of the Witches book. So my interest in Summers was really his writings on the vampire, the werewolf, and to some extent witchcraft and black magic. But most people, whether they're reading the history of witchcraft or the geography of witchcraft, another one he wrote, I think they will have some trouble coming to terms with his position on it, because to say it's politically incorrect is putting it mildly. He was fascinated, even obsessed by these things, but he is consistently hostile in a way which most people would find very illiberal today.
We're in a situation with a sort of Harry Potter resurgence in interest in this topic, and actually quite a lot of people would argue that there's really nothing wrong with white witchcraft at all, that it's the black magic that people need to watch out for.
Yes, well, that's a position of pure ignorance, isn't it? The fact is that even the phrase white witchcraft is of itself a complete contradiction of term. How can you have white witchcraft? I mean, when I speak of witchcraft, I'm speaking in the biblical sense, in the sense that witchcraft has always been understood to be how it was understood in medieval times and before, not in this quasi-feminist movement of New Agers who are usually vegetarian and wear sandals. But I don't think these people are anything to do with witchcraft. Now, they might call themselves that, but this business with Wicca is a modern creation, a modern invention, has nothing to do with witchcraft whatsoever.
Well, what's the purpose of it, then?
Oh, you must ask them. I think it's because they want a pagan alternative to organized religion. They don't want Christianity or any of the other monotheistic religion. They want something which they think is a little bit more interesting and exciting, and are willing to open doors without realizing what's entering. But these people are not really witches in the real meaning of the word. And white witchcraft, I mean, what is white witchcraft? If we're honest to define what witchcraft is, worship and evocation of what Christians would regard as demons and demonic entities, they wouldn't necessarily, that is to say, the Wiccans. But, I mean, real black magicians, Satanists, Diabolists, ceremonial magicians, ritual magicians, they would have nothing but pure contempt for people who... In fact, I wrote a book called From Satan to Christ, in which I describe a young girl's fascination with witchcraft during her immediate postgraduate period. And she joins a witchcraft coven in London and slowly realizes that the secrets, I mean, after her initiation into the 3 degrees of witchcraft, she begins to realize that, of course, it is something altogether more sinister, and the secrets about which they all keep talking are really hardcore Satanism. I mean, I've met lots of witches. I've known some of the most famous witches of my time, and there's no question about it that behind closed doors, what they're really about is what you would call black magic. They don't use those terms. I mean, they use a complete different vocabulary, but what they're really describing, what they're doing, is nothing short of diabolism, sorcery.
That was the Right Reverend Sean Manchester talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling about one of Bristol's great experts in the occult. The Right Reverend Montagu Summers was writing and publishing from his home in Clifton between the First and Second World Wars, and we'll hear the final part of this interview, how Sean Manchester believes people are sucked into selling their souls to the dark side, next week. 60 years ago this month, George VI died and Princess Elizabeth, heir to the throne, was in Kenya when she heard the news. She flew back to London and you're now going to hear some archive material from 1952 about that event. But first, let's hear from Queen Victoria's diary, in which she wrote the details of how she was broken the news to that William IV had died and that she was now Queen of Great Britain. The date was 1837.
I was awoke at 6 o'clock by Mama, who told me the Archbishop of Canterbury and Lord Conyngham were here and wished to see me. I got out of bed and went into my sitting room alone, only in my dressing gown, and saw them. Lord Conyngham then acquainted me that my poor uncle, the King, was no more, and had expired at 2:12 this morning, and consequently that I am Queen.
That was an entry from the diary of Queen Victoria. So now you're going to hear some archive material about Princess Elizabeth's tour to Kenya in 1952 and how it was cut short by the death of her father, George VI, on the 6th of February 1952.
On the tarmac at London Airport, there began yesterday a royal mission. 3,000 people crowded all approaches to the airfield as the time for the royal departure drew near. And shortly before noon, the crowd's cheers heralded the arrival of the King's car, bringing their Majesties and Princess Margaret to the airport for a last farewell to the royal travellers. More crowds lined the royal route to the departure point, as from the lounge, the King and Queen moved out onto the tarmac. At the King's side walked Sir Miles Thomas, chairman of BOAC. It was His Majesty's first major public appearance since last September, when the nation first learned of his illness. Following their majesties came the royal tourists. Less than 3 months after returning from their Canadian tour, Princess Elizabeth and the Duke of Edinburgh were off on another Commonwealth journey. Ahead of them this time lay a 30,000-mile trip that will take them in 5 months to four continents. The Argonaut airliner Atalanta of British Overseas Airways was to fly the royal couple on the first stage of their journey, the 4,400 miles to Nairobi. And as the Princess and the Duke stepped aboard, it was goodbye to Britain until July. The last farewells were said in the privacy of the aircraft, and Mr. Churchill was among those to board the airliner and wish the royal travellers a safe journey. An icy wind swept across the tarmac and through the crowds that waited for the royal party to leave the aircraft. The Duke and Duchess of Gloucester were first, and then on the stroke of noon, the King and Queen stepped down from the airliner. The departure was at hand. The journey which, but for his illness, the King himself would have undertaken, was almost underway. While all was made ready for the flight, the King and Queen and their party stayed out on the tarmac. There was a final wave, and then the great airliner moved off. 12:10, and the Atalanta was ready for the takeoff. From the roof of an airport building, the royal party looked on, the King still hatless in front. Nineteen hours later, the royal plane landed at Nairobi, on the eastern coast of Africa. And from there, the royal couple will travel on Sunday to Sagana Lodge in the foothills of Mount Kenya. Set amid a dense forest full of big game, the lodge was Kenya's wedding present to the Princess and the Duke. Here, they'll spend a short holiday before leaving Mombasa next Thursday by sea for Ceylon. The Princess was taking a short rest in the hunting lodge in Kenya when she received the news of her father's death. Immediately, the remainder of the tour was cancelled, and this young girl returned home with the Prime Minister and Ministers of State waiting to receive her at the airport, for Princess Elizabeth was now our sovereign, a sad and lonely figure whom fate had called upon to shoulder so young, so heavy a burden. The streets of London were filled once more, as they had been on many a past occasion. But now there were no cheers, no smiles or waving handkerchiefs, only the silence of a multitude in deep respect and sympathy for the homecoming of a queen for whom private grief must take second place to duty.
The King had died at Sandringham, and on a winter day, before the earth began to stir with new life, this was the last farewell to the Norfolk land he loved. They brought him to London for the lying in state. Then the gun carriage bore him on one last journey through the capital to the resting place of kings at Windsor. To Windsor, to the home of kings for centuries past, followed the slight figure of the daughter who was now our queen.
The Queen celebrates her long reign of 60 years this year, her Diamond Jubilee. But will she beat Queen Victoria's long reign, which lasted 63 years and 71 days? Our next feature is from Anthea Page, and it's an interview with Howard Utting at Arnold's Vale Cemetery. He is talking about his father, who was a superintendent there, and Howard grew up in the cemetery, living in one of the lodge gatehouses, and he now works there as a volunteer. His father is buried in the grounds of the cemetery, and this will be followed by an interview with a family who organised the funeral of a family member as a DIY funeral.
My dad and me were up in the little chapel, and they're putting the candles out on the little altar up there, and the big altar candles. I mean, they're church candles, like in a big church, really. So they're big candles, and this one was only halfway down, and he nicked his thumb and forefinger and put the flame out. And for some unknown reason, I mean, I can all remember it, and I didn't expect it, I was just helping him. He said, "You know, my boy lies like that." I said, "Like what?" He said, "That candle." He said, "If you're lucky," and he said, "There's a certain amount of element of luck in life, I'm afraid, and I think he's right, there is, you can go all the way down. But," he said, "this one's only halfway down yet." He said, "I can light. This isn't like us." He said, "If that flame goes out in us, then it's out. But," he said, "with the candle, it's got a second chance." So he said, "You know, that's what life's about." And little did he realise that his daughter, who's my sister, was only 52, and she died of throat cancer in 6 weeks. She was dead. And I thought, I was 10 years older than my sister, and I thought, the rule of things, I thought, as a boy, when she was born, I was 10. When I was 15, she was 5, so she was my little sister. And I thought, ooh, that's a thing. I'd probably die before Elaine, my sister. But, like my father said, with that candle and the flame, he luckily had died himself, so he didn't have to see her. It would have greatly troubled him, because I think it would have brought back to him what he told me. That flame, you're only halfway down.
Hilary, tell us about your homemade funeral, your father's funeral, which I believe you planned yourself.
Well, he planned it because he was aware he was probably going to die before very long. He said, "I want to remain at home." He really wanted to be buried on the farm, but my mother said, "No, I'm not having you in the field. You know, we'll have to take you to the crematorium," but that was okay. So we planned with him and got a cardboard coffin because he didn't want to have the expense of a great big, you know, £2,000 wooden coffin. And when he died, he remained at home, and my brother and my husband Dan stitched him up.
The shroud, Dan.
The shroud, right. Well, last couple of days, he was at home in bed downstairs, and the district nurse had suggested that he lay on a couple of sheets because she knew that the intention was for him to be put into a coffin there and then. She said two sheets will be better than one because one might rip. So he died. And then my brother-in-law, Hugh, using a sack stitching machine, which is they use for storing grain, stitched up the sheet so he was, well and truly stitched up. And then we, three of us, heaved him off the bed onto a big piece of plywood to carry him out and sort of manoeuvred him out of the farmhouse into one of the barns where it was cooler because he couldn't stay in the house because it was hot and obviously, you know, dead bodies, heat and all the rest. So he was in the barn on a couple of trestles and we pleaded with the crematorium to have a slot that week. He died on Tuesday evening and Friday morning, first thing, they said, "Yes, quick, we'll let you in the first on the queue." So 9 a.m. Friday morning. So we got him into his cardboard coffin in the barn and then manoeuvred that into the back of the Volvo estate. And off we went to the Kettering crematorium. And there we had a very, very personal family ceremony. No undertakers, nobody else, just ourselves. It was fantastic.
Hilary, how did your mother feel about the whole thing?
She was very pleased that we were able to do just what he wanted, and it all worked so well. And we all wrote messages on the coffin in big felt pen letters and stuck things on it. No, it was really very, very nice.
Sam, you're the grandson. How did you feel about the whole thing?
I was a bit apprehensive. So I didn't want to be involved in the stitching him up, putting him in the bag process. But me and my brother helped carry him into the crematorium. And it was really nice to be so personal. And it was nice to be able to write on the coffin. And it was what Papa, as the granddad, what he wanted. So we all sort of thought it was, you know, it was a very nice service. And
do you think any of your friends will copy your example?
Yes, I think certainly our friends John and Jen, particularly John, was very taken with the way that we were able to send my dad off. Yeah.
Do you think it helped you cope more with the bereavement?
Well, I'm sure, yes. But we'd had plenty of time. We'd had 6 years, really, to get used to the fact that, you know, he might go. And he was very, not happy to go, but he said, "Don't be sad. I've had a good life. I've been able to plan my death, and not many people can do that." And, you know, he was very positive, which helped us all enormously. It's helped me still now to cope with it.
How's your mother coping?
Well, my mum copes very well with whatever life throws her.
Does your mother, does she want a funeral like that?
I don't think we've dared broach the subject with her yet. She's so fit and healthy, touch wood, that I can see my mum going on for many, many years yet. But she, I think, would want something very simple and similar.
Dan, the crematorium, were they resistant to the idea or not?
Not at all. Very helpful. They thought it was a great idea and they did everything they could to help us. They were fantastic. We were quite surprised how proactive they were in allowing us to do a DIY funeral.
Do you think the undertakers might get a bit worried?
Well, they might do, but I suppose it's a very tiny minority of people who want to do this sort of route to the, you know, burying or cremating their relatives. So I'm sure we're one of a tiny minority.
And it's not very often these days that people die at home, because once you're in the hospital system, you're caught up with all sorts of other routes of...
Well, I think it's pretty difficult getting your relative's body from a hospital morgue. Very difficult.
Hilary, where did you find the coffin from? Because I believe it was in your garage for some weeks, yeah?
It was in our garage for some months, but prior to that I'd been on the internet and looked for cardboard coffins, and there are several companies that do them. Willow, all sorts of coffins, really. You can get whatever you want these days.
What's the cost of a cardboard coffin?
I think, from memory, about £90.
That's a huge saving.
It is, yes. You're talking thousands for a wooden coffin or something.
Yeah, but they're going to get burnt anyway, so... Yes.
And the fact it was cardboard was lovely, because we could decorate it however we wanted. So it made it very personal. And you can get them ordered, you know, with your favourite football team colours. I mean, really, the world's your oyster these days. It's amazing on the internet what you can find.
That was Anthea Page talking to Harold Utting at Arnisfail Cemetery, and followed by an interview with the Kantorowicz family about their DIY funeral of a member of the Shrive family. Time now for Chapter 32, Part 2, this week, of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve. I believe that we only have two of these left now, so enjoy.
Then, what's he doing with an echo to him? I should like to know. That ain't in nature, surely. This argument seemed weak enough to me, but you can never tell what will affect the superstitious, and to my wonder, George Merry was greatly relieved. "Well, that's so," he said. "You've a head upon your shoulders, John. No mistake. About shit, mates. This here crew is on a wrong tack, I do believe, and to come to think on it, it was like Flint's voice, I grant you, but not just so clear a way like it. After all, it was like her, someone else's voice now. It was like her, by the powers, Ben Gunn," roared Silver.
"Aye, and so it were,"
cried Morgan, springing on his knees.
"Ben Gunn it were."
"It don't make much odds now, do it?" asked Dick. "Ben Gunn's not here in the body, any more than Flint." But the older hands greeted this remark with scorn. "Why, nobody minds Ben Gunn," cried Merry. "Dead or alive, nobody minds him.
It was extraordinary how their spirits had returned and how the natural colour had revived in their faces. Soon they were chatting together with intervals of listening, and not long after, hearing no further sound, they shouldered the tools and set forth again, Merry walking first, with Silver's compass to keep them on the right line with Skeleton Island. He had said the truth. Dead or alive, nobody minded Ben Gunn. Dick alone still held his Bible and looked around him as he went with fearful glances, but he found no sympathy, and Silver even joked him on his precautions. "I told you," said he, "I told you you had spoiled your Bible. If it ain't no good to swear by, what do you suppose a spirit will give for it now? Not that." And he snapped his big fingers, halting a moment on his crutch. But Dick was not to be comforted. Indeed, it was soon plain to me that the lad was sick, hastened by heat, exhaustion, and the shock of his alarm. The fever predicted by Dr. Livesey was evidently growing swiftly higher. It was fine open walking here upon the summit. Our way lay a little downhill, for as I have said, the plateau tilted towards the west. The pines, great and small, grew wide apart, and even between the clumps of nutmeg and azalea, wide open spaces baked in the hot sunshine. Striking, as we did, pretty near northwest across the island, we drew, on the one hand, ever nearer under the shoulders of the spyglass, and on the other, looked ever wider over that western bay where I had once tossed and trembled in the coracle. The first of the tall trees was reached, and by the bearing proved the wrong one, so with the second. The third rose nearly 200 feet into the air above a clump of underwood, a giant of a vegetable with a red column as big as a cottage and a wide shadow around it in which a company could have manoeuvred. It was conspicuous far to sea, both on the east and west, and might have been entered as a sailing mark upon the chart. But it was not its size that now impressed my companions. It was the knowledge that £700,000 in gold lay somewhere buried below its spreading shadow. The thought of the money, as they drew nearer, swallowed up their previous terrors. Their eyes burned in their heads. Their feet grew speedier and lighter. The whole soul was bound up in that fortune, that whole lifetime of extravagance and pleasure that lay waiting there for each of them. Silver hobbled, grunting on his crutch. His nostrils stood out and quivered. He cursed like a madman when the flies settled on his hot and shiny countenance. He plucked furiously at the line that held me to him, and from time to time turned his eyes upon me with a deadly look. Certainly he took no pains to hide his thoughts, and certainly I read them like print. In the immediate nearness of the gold, all else had been forgotten. His promise and the doctor's warning were both things of the past, and I could not doubt that he hoped to seize upon the treasure, find and board the Hispaniola under cover of night, cut every honest throat upon the island, and sail away as he had at first intended, laden with crimes and riches. Shaken as I was with these alarms, it was hard for me to keep up with the rapid pace of the treasure hunters. Now and again I stumbled, and it was then that Silver plucked so roughly at the rope and launched at me his murderous glances. Dick, who had dropped behind us and now brought up the rear, was babbling to himself both prayers and curses as his fever kept rising. This also added to my wretchedness. And to crown it all, I was haunted by the thought of the tragedy that had once been acted on this plateau, when that ungodly buccaneer with the blue face, he who died at Savannah, singing and shouting for drink, had there, with his own hand, cut down his six accomplices. This grove, that was now so peaceful, must then have rung with cries, and even with that thought, I could believe I heard it ringing still. We were now at the margin of the thicket. "Huzzah, mates! All together!" shouted Merry, and the foremost broke into a run. And suddenly, not 10 yards farther, we beheld them stop. A low cry arose. Silver doubled his pace, digging away with the foot of his crutch like one possessed. And next moment he and I had come also to a dead halt. Before us was a great excavation, not very recent, for the sides had fallen in and grass had sprouted on the bottom. In this were the shaft of a pick broken in two, and the boards of several packing cases strewn around. On one of these I saw branded with a hot iron the name Walrus, the name of Flint's ship. All was clear to probation. The cash had been found and rifled. The £700,000 had gone.
That was Chapter 32, Part 2 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read very kindly for us by Malcolm Grieve. With me now in the studio, I have Tim Burrows. Hi, Tim.
Hi, hi.
Haven't had you in for a little while. How have you been?
Oh, fine. Yeah, great, great.
Good. What do you have for us today?
Well, my voice is a bit tired at the moment, so I'm going to do a poem. It's a poem about... There's so much to talk about, but people don't talk about it, and radio stations don't talk about it. So it's called I'm Okay. I'm okay as long as I don't say anything. I'm okay as long as I don't give anything away. I'm okay as long as the dark past becomes the history that's today. I'm okay as long as the lies are current, as long as the tabloid still holds sway. I'm okay as long as I don't say the Murdochs don't lie every day. I'm okay if I forget that Tibet is Tibetan. I'm okay if I don't curse that the bankers are allowed to rule our world. I'm okay if I don't say the planet is too hot and that greed is not allowed. So if you don't want a truthful answer and you don't want to hear the worst, go ahead and stick the future up your own unenlightened part.
Thank you, Tim. You have a website, I hear.
Yes, I've finally managed to set up my own website for my poetry and my music, and it's timburrows.co.uk, and
great.
It's on iPage.
And you also have some dialect snippets on there as well.
That's right, some of the poems and some of the work I've done with dialect over the last year is going to be on there, so thank you.
How exciting, check it out.
Thank you.
It's my great pleasure to welcome Rosemary Dunn back into the studio. Hello, Rosemary.
Hi there.
And what do you have for us today?
Okay, well, it's a poem about celebrities, because these days, whenever there's some crisis around the world, one or other celebrity mouths off or offers help to fly in with their jet, having seemingly forgotten that their job is to play dress-up for a living. So this is called Celebs to the Rescue. In La La Land, movie stars have all been stirred. They've heard loud the media clarion call. The earth's in dire need of their glittering wise words. If that's not enough, they'll have a charity ball. Giggly Goldie Hawn thinks meditation is the key to fixing education in the West. Up in Sheffield, Dolly Parton sponsors books and libraries while politicians try not to ogle her big chest. Sage-like Sharon Stone has solemnly decreed that China's earthquake was down to bad karma. And Richard Gere's heart often publicly bleeds as he sups tea with Tibet's Dalai Lama. Tom Cruise doesn't care about suckers like us. He has his spaceship booked for Judgment Day. Hallelujah. Sitting smug and pretty on the Thetan's happy bus. But he'll sue you if you out him as a gay. John Travolta wants it known he's doing all he can with his private jumbo jet for those in Haiti. Tax evading Bono fancies he's God's right man, even lending God his shades because they're so matey. So world rejoice, celebrities are wise and wondrous saviours, gracing us with sugar-coated edicts. Ignore their vulgar lives, excess and dubious behaviour, or that most are strung out insecure ex-addicts. They clamour in their glamour, crass and unself-aware, desperate for our love like orphaned gannets. With their millions and their Botox and their oh-so-perfect hair, this galaxy of stars will save our poor planet. God help us all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. I'm afraid we haven't got any Jeff this week, but he's reliably sent on his What's On Guide and his Song of the Week, so here it is. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect, starting with Friday, 17th of February, Priest Unleashed, The Vast and Made to Waste will all be performing at the Hatchet in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £3 in advance and £4 on the door, with proceeds going to the Alzheimer's Society and also Macmillan Cancer Support. Doors open at 8. Also on the 17th of February, the ex-Inspiral Carpets vocalist Tom Hingley will be performing with support from Taser Puppets and Bill Orrick at the Continental in South Meadow Lane, Preston. Tickets are £6 in advance and doors open at 8. On to Song of the Week, and I present Johnny Cash. He has been classed as one of the most influential musicians of the 20th century, and even though he was mainly a country musician, his music spanned many genres. He's included in three Hall of Fames, namely country music, rock and roll, and gospel music. This is from the album Ain't No Grave, and it's the song titled Ain't No Grave.
There ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. When I hear that trumpet sound, I'm gonna rise right out of the ground. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. Well, look way down the river, and what do you think I see? I see a band of angels, and they're coming after me. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. Well, look down yonder, Gabriel. Put your feet on the land and sea. But Gabriel, don't you blow your trumpet till you hear from me. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. Meet me, Jesus, meet me. Meet me in the middle of the air. And if these wings don't fail me, I will meet you anywhere. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. Well, meet me, mother and father. Meet me down the river road. And mama, you know that I'll be there when I check in, my Lord. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down.
That was Johnny Cash with Ain't No Grave from the album Ain't No Grave. For more information, you can check out www.johnnycash.com. Into Saturday, the 18th of February, Kevin Montgomery will be performing with support at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse, Bristol. Tickets are £15 in advance and £17 on the door, and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday the 19th of February, the Blue Angel Acoustic Cafe will be at The Horn in Victoria Street, St Albans. Entry is free and the event starts at 8. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye. That's all from Dialect this week. Our studio guest was Colin McNamee, and we had features from Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Alec Milne researched the archive audio from 1952 for us. We had Malcolm Grieve reading Chapter 32, Part 2 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. We had poetry from Rosemary Dunn and Tim Burrows, and we had the What's On Guide prepared by Jeff Sparks and read by me. The presenter was me, Michaela Dennis, and the producer was Anthea Page. Our studio engineer was Michael Noyce. See you next week.